We can go ahead and start the tape. And let's start by a quick review. This model is most important today. It's a model that I've shared in all of our talks together. And it's an important model because it's multidimensional understanding of awareness and behavior. And that's not a new thing, but certainly earlier on in this century in medicine and psychology, we looked for single cause understanding of behavior, thoughts, feeling, and illnesses. And we're at a place today where we look at people multidimensionally. We're aware that your consciousness or your human awareness is made up of thoughts and feelings, but the same type of a feeling can come from any one of these areas. And today, as we talk about behavior change, it's really important that we respect these different areas if we're going to respect ourselves. Because sometimes we oversimplify ourselves and then we don't do a good job at behavior change. Behavior change is a great industry in America. If you're looking for a business to go into to make a lot of money, this is a good one, particularly since it has a 98% failure rate, but as much as a 50 to 60% return rate of customers. So you're going to get a lot of return business. Your folks are going to fail. They're going to typically not blame that on themselves, because in behavior change industry, we're really good at making sure that the customer feels guilty and bad when they fail. And so we want to look today at this whole business. Now, many of you are familiar with the 12-step program about how to own our weaknesses and acknowledge our life history and to change slowly. I come from Portland, Oregon, where we have a one-step plan in the city. And we've imported it to most of America, and it's called Just Do It. And unfortunately, it's that one-step plan that many of us try to impose on other people and sometimes ourselves. And the trouble is that we just have loads of empirical research evidence that willpower does not work. And we can look at that. We can get some examples if you want to share your personal failures and successes later on. I'd like to start with two quotes, and they're on the handout, but I'm going to take the time to read them. The first is from the book of Philippians, and the second is from C.S. Lewis. In Philippians, we read, "I thank my God every time I remember you in all my prayers for all of you. I always pray with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now, being confident of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion until the day of Christ Jesus." And I certainly don't want you to take that as a proof text verse that you'll be able to lose weight, get rid of your anger, be more patient, or something else as a promise from God. But I think we have an implication here that God is going to stay the course with us, and that's what I'd like us to get from this verse, not a proof text that he'll help us do one particular thing. And then from the Screwtape Letters, if you've read that, you recognize this. "My dear Wormwood, I note with grave displeasure that your patient," who of course is a person, Wormwood is a devil, "has become a Christian. There's no need to despair. Hundreds of these adult converts have been reclaimed after a brief sojourn in the enemy's camp," and that's our Lord's camp, "and are now with us. All the habits of the patient, both mental and bodily, are still in our favor." And you know what that feels like. Many of you can recall times of faith experiences, or you've had neighbors or children or friends who've had faith experiences. And yet what happens after the new experience is that the old power, that underground force of habit, begins to return and erodes away those changes. And what we want to look at today is maybe a way to sustain some of the changes that you and I would hope to put into our lives. One thing we want to start with is really getting it clear that it's very tempting to look for one path or one road to change or to solution, and to then impose that on people. And again, that's a real gift of being at Holden, because at Holden there's an idea of multiplicity, more than one road, more than one avenue, more than one way of being. But when we talk about change, and when you subject yourself to people who are in the business of changing you, very, very often we don't find multiplicity. We don't find careful empathizing with an individual's particular self, but rather we find the application of a formula to all people universally, and the people who fail then are considered failures, not different people who should have been using a different road. And that's what we want to look at. You know, it's very fortunate, though, that students and learners are smart, and I thought we'd take a minute to get an example from some of you. Have you noticed that students and learners know how to drop out of those teachers that don't fit them? Some of you.
Yes, but then the teachers have the pleasure of giving them a failing. The students who have dropped out, failing grade, right?
Right. That's that difficult interaction where if you're with a person who's very powerful, and people are, you know, some people fit that person, don't they? Some people fit most every teacher. And so when there's that match, then that's that professor or person in authority can have a lot of power. But students are smart. They know how to get out of schools that don't fit them and get to ones that do. We know how to go from church to church until we find the message or the pastor or the atmosphere that fits us. And of course, when we leave, the group we're leaving puts an F on us as a failure. But often the group we're arriving to welcomes us. But I thought we might take a minute and see if someone might give an example or two of a time when they left a teacher or a learner, an experience where you were a learner, and found a better fit, and how you did better in that second environment than the first.
I think a lot of kids in high school, they just don't fit, and they're failures, and they drop out, and they go to work, and they're successful.
Mm-hmm.
And they just need to get out of school.
Mm-hmm. Sure, there is a group of kids that do much better just getting out and get going than trying to conform to a certain school system.
Mm-hmm. I was in a private high school, Camp Prokill High School, and I had to commute quite a distance away from my home to get there, and because of that I didn't get to socialize with a lot of kids that were in that school. My parents did it for the academics and the religious education, and I begged my parents to let me go to the community high school, public high school, in my neighborhood, and I was having trouble getting along with the nuns that taught me at the other school. I was really getting to be a little troublemaker. And when I went into the public school, just a matter of blocks from my house, I really began to thrive in this new environment. Mm-hmm. This is a big, big, big major change for my family. That was the first to have ever done that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good example, because some people did well in that private school, maybe even other people in your family, but you did better in a different setting. And that's what we want to understand here, is that there's more than one avenue. And the important way, the skill of a guide is to be able to match the avenues and the timing and the techniques to the person that they're supposed to be nurturing, rather than imposing a preset formula. The advantage of formulas is that, and this is what makes testimonials work great, they work 30% of the time. That's a rough rule of treatment in psychology, that 30% of the population's responsive to hypnosis, 30%'s responsive to a certain kind of therapy or so on. And if you build all of your explanations around this 30%, you've got a great caseload. And again, the same thing is true in healthcare. People tend to self-select towards those parts of healthcare that work for them, or towards those types of counselors or pastors or whoever. Well, let's go on now and look quickly at Roman numeral 1, which is the false promise, and that's willpower. That's the one-step program of Nike that says just do it, and that's the program that many of us were raised with. We often use the teaching of Scripture to set our standards by. And then I think we do something that's not Christian as I read the New Testament, and that is we try to make all the changes with my own self power. And as I read the New Testament, there's a sense that there's supposed to be help and compassion and support outside of myself. And I'll let you interpret that however you would, however you understand the Holy Spirit, however you understand the community of believers, however you understand the role of Jesus in your life. But I don't have the sense as I read the New Testament that it's a new set of standards and now I am supposed to somehow go off and do it. But I think that can take place in our churches because it's easy for some of us to conform to some of the standards. It really is. Some of you very easily, by the nature of the person you are not going to have trouble in certain areas of personal growth or piety or success or determination. Those things are going to come very natural to you. For other people, they're going to be very difficult. So we tend to do something in teaching and in modeling that's really a flip-flop. We take the areas that are easiest for us, and people who have a great deal of trouble in those areas come to us, and we tell them how we did it. You see, that's the reverse of the way it ought to be. For those of us who fail in an area and have a great deal of struggle there, we ought to be the ones that model in that area for other people who are struggling. And in part, that's the genius of the self-help 12-step movement, which has been far more successful statistically in dealing with substance abuse, for example, than the whole mental health community. And there was a great war between the mental health community and the self-help AA movement years ago. And you know who won? The self-help movement. So you know what the professionals did? We tried to take it over because you better not get beat and go home. So now the professional world is promoting the AA 12-step self-help model. But there's a nice feature of that, and that is that people who are struggling in an area then become the models for other folks rather than people who've never had trouble there. Well, let's go down to the heart of our work today, and that is Roman numeral 2, meeting our unique selves. And I'd like some illustrations from yourselves today. And what we're talking about here are two areas primarily, our unique biological self and our unique psychological self. Certainly, in some degrees, we share an environment, although your home environment may have been very different than the neighbor next door. Although you were both in the same community, one home might have been filled with alcoholism, another home sexual abuse, another home a very healthy communicative model of child raising. And also spiritual values may have been very different from place to place. But I want us to look at our unique selves, and we're starting now with the good stuff. Understanding unique things about you that you have that the person sitting next to you does not have. We're talking right now about differences, not just similarities. Now these differences, the nice thing is, we say, oh boy, we can't start looking at differences, we'll just, everybody's the same. That's not true. Differences will sort out into categories. And this is a time when I might encourage some of you to track down the director here, Scott Hatchford, who, from my understanding, is an expert in Jungian psychology. And Jungian psychology has some of the keys for us in terms of these categories that make us different. But the good news is these categories aren't unlimited. But we still need to recognize them. Let's stop for a minute and see if some of you might share differences that you discovered growing up, maybe between yourself and your brothers and sisters. maybe differences that you discovered after you got married in terms of your own learning history that was very different from your partner's? And we're talking now about on the positive side, good things that you got. Yeah.
One of the things that I learned at a previous session here at Holden was about different styles of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered, my husband and I did, that we had different learning styles of auditory and visual, and that those produce actual different characteristics. And whereas we always had a quarrel about the alarm clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, it was understandable why I hated to hear the alarm clock, and for him it was, so what?
Okay, that's the stuff. Susie, could you help read Alan's work and help communicate? Somebody else.
Social education.
Mm-hmm.
Social education.
Special education.
Special education. Uh-huh. As a unique personal history.
Mm-hmm.
How many of you are morning people? We can help get this real simple. Morning people? Night people? Married to the same kind. Do you know that if you're married to the same circadian rhythm, that you have a few less fights and a little more lovemaking? Statistically measured. That if you're opposite circadian rhythms, you have a few more fights and a little less lovemaking. Okay. Other genetic factors. Go ahead.
I know it's good for my brothers and sisters.
I am very quick.
You are very quick.
I am very quick.
Very quick.
Very quick. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are very slow who don't have a lower IQ. Can you think about your kids? Maybe that'd be a little easier on some of these lines. To think about how some of these genetic differences, and sometimes we don't respect them in people.
Yeah. No.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've been in situations where it's explained in terms of the introvert-extrovert difference,
mm-hmm.
but people process, I take longer to process a decision if something gets thrown at the group and we have to decide what we're going to do, I will need to sit and here's the pros and here's the cons. And the bigger the decision, the longer I'll try and work it through. And other people will say, well, hey, let's just do this. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, fine.
Right. Right. And those are legitimate differences. Mm-hmm.
Maybe another way to say that is something that I think I'm becoming more aware of is that you can come to understanding and knowledge and hopefully more often than not correct decisions by an intuitive way of rash thinking,
mm-hmm.
or of learning,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to logical.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different skill.
Right, and for some people, intuition, and I would suggest that intuition is genetically based, that it's distributed in the population both in men and women, that it's not just a women's trait. And again, that's a Jungian idea.
Mm-hmm. I test out 3 standard deviations on intuition. and I grew up in a family of women. And I think I'm head and shoulders above them, not better than,
mm-hmm.
but in that one category.
Mm-hmm.
Another category that segregates me from my siblings was humor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether it was the school that I went to that brought it out of me, but I saw great things to laugh at and have fun at in school, which didn't make me very successful. but my sisters were all real good and on the line, and it wasn't a bit of humor in it, but got good grades, for whatever that's about.
All right. Now take a minute and look at Roman numeral 3, which is just the same. But it's the negative side of this. Some of us genetically, biologically, didn't get as much as other folks. And that's true in all forms of our life. And it's possible, and I would suggest that we have seven different types of intelligences. There's a book on that, if you might like to read it, called Frames of Mind. Now, how many of you are musical? Really? Okay. Now, how many of you are really musical? I mean, bona fide. Okay. See, there's a difference, isn't there? And I'm one of the musical illiterates, and I've tried to take some music lessons, but it just doesn't connect. And music is probably one of those areas that some people get more than others. Physically, some people grow to 7 feet and others don't. And also, and this is a very sad area, but it's something we can't minimize at all, many of us have personal histories where we were severely damaged and hurt, and the evidence is that that it's very widespread, and this affects our change too. And this is why when we go into a program and someone wants to sell us a model of change and they don't take into account our unique strengths and weaknesses, we can really be set up. So, before we go on to the specific things that I want to look at today in terms of resources, time, and technique.
And maybe sometime I put things up.
What would you think in terms of mental health now, your own thoughts and feelings, what would be one of the most least likely times you could succeed at making good, successful personal change efforts? What would be some of the biggest detriments?
If you were depressed.
Why?
Because your emotions aren't the lowest way of things.
Low energy.
Lack of energy.
Low energy?
Chemistry.
What else?
Stress. External stress, either job or
Illness.
Illness? When do you usually get handed the weight loss diet?
Right after somebody else went on it.
Often we get handed this is a real common practice in general practice medicine, that if you go in and see your physician and you've got bad back problems, chronic pain or whatever, I see lots of patients like this. They come to me and I say, well, what did your doctor say? He said, well, come try hypnosis, and he gave me this weight loss plan. But the person's suffering from chronic pain, and they're in a major stress time, and now they're going to institute a weight loss program that they failed at, and you know, you inquire, how long have you tried to lose weight? Since I was 16, I'm 45, I'm 80 pounds overweight. Is there any likelihood you're going to lose weight now? There's none. There's none at all. See, in fact, the weight loss statistics are this, that 98% of the population is not able to keep the weight they lose off for more than 2 years, and in fact, 98% of the population weighs more and is bigger 2 years after they attempted to lose the weight. Because you lose protein and you gain fat, so the phrase is, you gain it back with interest. That's the evidence. David Garner, who's a psychologist in Canada, an international expert on anorexia, bulimia, weight loss, and weight gain, would say that there's no medical evidence that you should ever prescribe a low-calorie diet for anyone, because we don't have any evidence that it works. But you've done a good job in highlighting these. And when do we usually decide to lose weight, quit smoking, be nicer, be more patient? Right in the middle of divorce, illness, job loss, financial stress, marital conflict. Very few of us decide to make changes when we're feeling good. We usually take on great life renovation at the very time it's least likely to succeed. That's really worth knowing, because depression you mentioned it first of all, it's the surefire killer to any personal change program. because depression pulls us back to our less efficient ways of functioning. We regress a bit when we're depressed. There's nothing wrong with that. You sort of retrench. Well, that's not a time you want to be pushing out and exploring new things and new behaviors. Well, now what we want to do is look at Americans, which I assume includes Canadians and other Westerners trying to compete and consume as fast as the rest of us in the States. And this is the real enemy of behavior change. Look at personal resources. Under A, the first thing we need to do is get a picture of our values as a resource. Normally, our values, what we want to change to, is considered an ideal, but a problem. You know, I'd really like to keep smoking. I just wish it didn't cause cancer. I'd really like to keep this weight on. I just wish it didn't have complications down the road for heart disease. I really wish I could keep being, you know, being impatient gets me a lot. It really is effective at work, particularly for men. We can, you know, snap and push and the world moves for us, but it doesn't work so well at home. So I need to come home and learn to be a little more patient so I can raise the kids and they won't turn out bad. But, you know, this impatience is fairly effective. So what happens is we often live in two worlds, and that's point B. We need to face our attempt to live in two or three worlds. And many, many of us really try to do that when we look at something we want to change. We aren't sold on change. We're sold on the consequences of change. I would like to be that way, but I'd still like to be this other way occasionally too. And I think the New Testament talks about this tension between double-mindedness, this tension between God and mammon, and this tension between wanting to live simply and to consume a lot at the same time. And so, you know, we have a potluck dinner at our house, and we just start a new diet, so what do? We eat before everybody gets there. And then you have, you know, you're very careful to only put appropriate things on your plate. And you see, those are just silly, small illustrations, though, of how we often seek to live in two worlds. And as long as we're doing that, again, what I want to encourage us to do is not to get on the bandwagon with a whip and beat ourselves up, but to sit down and say, I'm not sure I'm ready to change. See, the first gift you need to give yourselves in change is to give yourself the freedom to not change. And that isn't permissiveness. That will not. See, there's no doubt that giving yourself permission to stay the same is going to increase your failure rate. The failure rate in change is so high that giving yourself the gift of not changing isn't going to increase your odds of failure at all. I assure you of that. Although it sounds funny, it just won't happen. Number C, let your family and friends see your values. Now, I don't mean, you know, call everybody over and give them a confessional. I'm about to do this. But I mean that we need to let our thoughts become actions, and we need, as we let them become actions, we also need to let them become words so that other people begin to check in with our value system. Let me give you an extreme example that I would think would not apply to anyone here today. But one of the things that we require when we work with recovering sex offenders of any sort is that they not keep their problem a secret. Because that secrecy creates two worlds. It creates inner tension. And we find that the sooner a man can let his wife know what's going on, that the more likely recovery is. And what's the classic response of the man? If I tell her, she'll leave me. Mm-hmm. What we know is that if he doesn't tell her, he's going to fail. That's right. If he tells her, she might leave. But it's going to bring this down to a figure that there may be some success at, even if he has to deal with the end of his marriage. And for many of, that's a very dramatic example, but it's an easy one for you to understand. Many of us need to go ahead and let our friends and our family see our values, whether it's a simpler lifestyle, whether it's a commitment to the Lord. And Jesus was interested in that, wasn't he? He was interested in us letting people know that we were disciples. And he asked us to do that, and I think there's some connection there. Point D, get the special resources you need based on your personality type, genetically, personal history-wise, for your strengths and weaknesses. Customize the change program to who you are personally. So, let's take an easy example. Someone mentioned extrovert-introvert difference. I forgot your first name. That only means Scott's a nicer guy than I am. Because I'm an extrovert and Susie's an introvert and there's noise in our house, which means I talk and interrupt her silence and he respects someone else's silence. What happens when an extrovert marries an introvert is when both people are fatigued, they want to do the opposite thing. And it's very frustrating because an extrovert wants to refuel by chatting and reflecting, and an introvert wants to go quietly, have a cup of tea on the back porch, and don't bug me. I'm refueling. Okay. So you need to just even think about that when you begin change. If you're an introvert, you don't want to schedule 4 parties in 1 week, because that's going to be draining. On the other hand, if you're an extrovert and you're making big change, you might want to solicit some contact from 2 or 3 key people to keep your energy banks full. That's a very simple idea about customizing the plan. But you want to do that for yourself. Now, look at number E, the practicalities of balancing a checkbook, sleep deprivation, and other deficits. How many of, don't raise your hand. We don't have to, we're Americans. How many of us live on credit? How many of us are in debt? How many of us try to live a little more ahead of where we're at? How many of us are sleep deprived? We believe across the board that Americans run sleep deprived at probably about a 90% rate in the population. One way to measure that is to see if you can take a nap this morning. Yeah, I could. Kids don't. Kids can't take naps until they're tired and they're not sleep deprived. Most of us are sleep deprived. And that's just another illustration of how we try to live on a deficit. And if you're going to make a change, you want to do it out of abundance and riches, not deficiencies. But again, we make change, typically we elect to do it during times of deficiency, during times of crisis, during times of difficulty. And so it's whether it's, you know, paying the bills, it works when you have enough money. Making change works when you have enough personal resources stored up. Any questions about that, about resources, before we go on?
Mm-hmm. I had a thought on this one about C, about communicating and no secrecy. I think another fear or reason for not, it's hard to do that, is that people will see us as a hypocrite. You know, you tell somebody, well, if you're going to share that, okay, I've become a Christian and I want to do this, they're going to expect you to do certain things, and obviously you're not, you just acted like a jerk. Or if I'm saying, you know, I really want to lose weight, you know, my husband's going to be all over my back, but why are you eating that? Why are you eating that? And that doesn't help. And the fear of all my mistakes being pointed out.
And that's why we're going to turn to this book next. Thank you. See? There are hordes. I mean, we could have brought, I think it would have been easy to bring you 200 titles on behavior change, easily, technique books. But instead I select for you a book by a lady feminist psychoanalyst called Harriet Lerner. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this book. She wrote The Dance of Anger, which was her popular book. But this is her gem. So if you like The Dance of Anger, or if you didn't like it, this is really her gem. It's The Dance of Intimacy. And it's a book about the interpersonal dynamics of change. And it's about selfhood as the basis for change rather than technique as the basis for change. And, you know, you're exactly right. When we begin to share with other people where we're headed, we set ourselves up because they read in their head a behavioral map that starts here and goes here, and they want to check you along the way. Mm-hmm. Oh, you bet. Your kids will monitor it, your spouses, your friends, your pastor, and everybody gives us grace as we go along. And I think a lot of what's going on is people are working out their own insecurities by watching us and by grading us, but it's really neat because we're the identified object and everybody can focus on us. So letting family and friends know is certainly not, you know, I'm not talking about the New Year's Eve resolution. See, that's a big setup. I'm talking about telling a good friend, you know, I'm headed down this road. And I plan to stay on this road. And that's what we get to in terms of time. Because in America, we have a terrible distortion of time when it comes to change. Let's look at that. Again, the first point is we need to set a timetable based on who we are, not distorted by depression or grandiosity. See, depression essentially is marked by an outlook of hopelessness and helplessness. I'll never make it. The flip side of depression sometimes is a grandiosity that says, man, I can make that, no problem. Not based on our abilities, but based on our insecurities. And grandiosity and depression are sometimes the different sides of the very same coin. So we need to set a timetable based on who we really are. And for some of us, learning something or changing is going to take 5 times as long as another person. Are you at peace about that? Can you accept that? That if you're going to read a book, you'll have it with you for 5 weeks and someone else will have it for 1 week. If you're going to learn to do something in the arts, it might take you months and months, and another person might do it immediately. Are you at peace with that? Because if we aren't, what do? If we're the slow folks,
get depressed.
We quit. We quit. Absolutely. And so let's look at making slow changes. And I wanted to read 2 passages from her book for you. And one is about a women's meeting, and it starts like this. While my own associations to the word conservative are not great ones, this word best describes my attitude towards personal change. Just as we strive for change, we also strive to conserve what is most valuable and familiar in ourselves. And in a society where we are constantly being pressured to improve, actualize, and perfect ourselves, is probably wise to question why we should change at all and who is prescribing the changes. And then she says later, plodding slowly forward is probably a good idea for us all. If I keep repeating this point, it is because the examples of this book are bound to invite an overly ambitious attitude, and that's the grandiosity. That's the flip side of my depression. Well, that mountain looks beautiful. I'm going to get to the top of it. I have described changes certain women have made over a period of years, sometimes with the help of therapy, and have condensed these changes into a chapter or even a page or two. This makes change look too easy, no matter what I say to the contrary. Change has to be slow. It needs to be slow. But we live in a world that values speed. And that's why we need to look at C&D, your commitment to stay the course. If you want to be a believer, or stop a habit, or alter a personality style, it's a commitment to stay the course. I know this is right. I know this is what I want for myself. I've made this decision. I want to hike up this trail and see the waterfall. And that's under D, a reflection on our educational system and hiking. One of the saddest discussions I had, it wasn't sad in sense of magnitude, but just the misunderstanding of the nature of life was when I was talking to a senior citizen a few months ago. She was describing on having camped at a place that I had camped, and I said, did you climb up and see the waterfall? And she said, I started up the trail, but I was with all the grandkids, and they ran ahead and they saw it, and then they ran back to camp, and so I decided to go back. And I said to her, well, why didn't you finish? Well, they were faster than I was. And the sadness I had was that this is a way this woman had lived a lot of her life. If people got there ahead of me, then they saw the waterfall first, or they took the first picture, and so it wasn't as special then for me. And so she turned around and came back. And we need to realize that you and I were educated, by and large, in a world that measured how fast you could do things, not just how well you did them. Can you think of any examples in that area from your own life of places when other people's timing, use of time, altered a goal that you were after?
Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, I was going to mention it earlier, my brothers were always faster at everything mm-hmm. than I was. And I puberty, they all race there ahead of me, and I still have the high voice and mm-hmm. all of that sort of thing. And a lot of sports activities I never got into simply because they were there ahead of me and they were so much better that the sports that I grew up playing, basketball and baseball, football, particularly basketball, I didn't participate in that much because they were just so far ahead. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then when I went away to college, I got into tennis and handball, mm-hmm. which is something they never did. Mm-hmm. And I was always a slow one. I mean, when you mentioned about being slow, that really drives me.
Yeah, we don't have much value for slowness. I mean, somebody else.
Is that peculiar just to American society, do you think?
You know, I'm really limited. I'm a clinical psychologist who practices in America, and I could pretend to know about other cultures, but I only know a bit by reading. I read they're slower. I have friends who come back from Germany who say it's wonderful and slow and the stores aren't open on Sunday. But I don't know any more about that than other folks here, so if you could respond to her.
Well, certainly we know that Native Canadian culture is slower. Mm-hmm. And people process before they speak, and they speak slowly and carefully, and they take time, and everyone listens to along
the
speech.
I think the more quote unquote primitive cultures, the native cultures, probably because they're in touch with the seasons of the earth and the pattern of nature, this is not so speedy always. There is much more respect and trust in slowness.
I had that feeling that from the travel that we've done, that there's not that pressure to change and always be slimmer, more beautiful, and whatever in other cultures. I just didn't know if that was because I haven't, you spend 3 weeks or 6 weeks in other culture, you have this sense that, well, they're just more relaxed and more accepting here. But I don't know if you lived there for a year, if you would find a whole set of different expectations.
People need to pop and smell the flowers.
One of the things that strikes me is that in the educational system, well, typical, as you've been saying too, in our society, everything is paced, and if you don't keep up to that pace, well, then you're automatically
some degree of misfit. And I have just been talking with the principal of a high school in Seattle, trying to get him to introduce something which to me would, I hope, encourage people to respect, you know, their own inner time and thought and step back from that pace recently. I've been trying to get him to introduce a 5-minute doodle, which is something that June Marsh down in Olympia came up with and introduced to the high school. You may have heard about it because of that. But what she has done is to have each of her classes start with a 5-minute doodle, because doodling is international. It's just universal. Everyone doodles. And they doodle uniquely out of who they are, for the most part. And they come up with incredible things. But it's a time where she has her students step back and simply spend time with themselves. And just, you know, let come or not come, whatever. So that it becomes really 5 minutes for reflecting and stepping out of this pace and saying, hey, I am me, let me just take account of who I am. And I had talked with her at one time about seeing if a whole school could do it. I mean, even the administration and secretary, as a way of revolting against this pace and saying, hey, let's try something more personal.
And we need to make sure we're not thinking now that slowness works for everybody. You need slowness and staying the course in areas that are difficult for you, but that doesn't mean that in an area that's easy for somebody else, they shouldn't run ahead. So we're not making slowness a virtue in itself. We're giving it space for an area that I might have difficulty in, or if I like slowness. That's what's so important about this, is understanding the diversity and the expense that's going to take place in change.
Had an experience when we were in Austria hiking with a lady, the mother of a friend of ours over there, and she went hiking with us up in the Alps. And I was in my 20s, we were in our 20s, and very energetic and loved to hike and hiked fast, being from America. And she had her own pace that she knew that she had to go in order to make the course that she had set. They had planned this hike up over to kind of a pass, only it's not a pass like where roads go by, it's just there's a hut up there and down through the meadows and on the other side. And I was exhausted going that pace. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was clearly not a pace. I had a very hard time going as slow as she did. But also, it was, it's taken me now, you know, 20 years later, I look back at that experience and I think that's real helpful to understand the kinds of differences. Fortunately, at the end, she bought me some schnapps and I felt fine.
Did you have a... Okay, let's move on to technique. We're about out of time, and I want to highlight this for you. Under technique, there's a couple books in the bookstore that I saw. Well, only one of these that did I see there. Celebration of Discipline by Foster. There's another good book called Spirit of the Disciplines. The nice thing about these books is they don't make the disciplines the goal, and that sometimes happens in Christianity. We make asceticism the goal rather than using Christian disciplines to foster our ability to live. We were talking about what do other people do when we change? And these are techniques you have to have ready now, because it's real common if you change for everyone in your world to ask you to change back. You play a role in their system. You fit. Whether you're the good guy, the funny guy, the smart guy, the fast guy, the slow guy, the bad dad, the dad with all the anger. You know, when a dad gives up his anger, people provoke him. They want him to come take that role again. I mean, we're real used to it. When mom finally loses weight, dad takes her out for ice cream. That's utterly common in our practice to see that as a routine response. That's not just a joke. That is so typical you wouldn't believe it. So, here's what she says. It's important to keep in mind that counter moves or change back reactions occur whenever we move towards a higher level of assertiveness, separateness, and maturity in any key relationship. We're the one initiating a change. We easily forget that counter moves express anxiety, not lack of love, and they're always predictable. Very important idea. And she gives, this is why this book is so useful, because it alerts us to what goes on internally, psychologically, in ourselves and in others when we seek to change. So when we change, and our partner says change back, what do we say? You don't love me. You don't support me. You're not in my camp. Rather, we need to be ready to say, it's tough when I change, isn't it? Or I'm a little more separate from you than I used to be, and that causes you a lot of frustration. You see, but usually we're disappointed because if we take all the time to change, what do you want? An applause. That's right. A celebration, a party. Instead, what do you get? Depression. Frustration. It can even happen when somebody finally completes a degree or finally gets a job. Those things can precipitate serious family problems because we were used to the person having a role. Also, we need to realize that inside of us are going to be voices that say change back. I was more comfortable in that other role too. And so we need to be ready to deal with our own internal voices that ask us to change back. Point D, living in our chosen environment. I love going to the video store.
Mm-hmm. I thought of one that just came to me. Regarding the changes in smoking behavior nationally, has that changed the effectiveness rate for smoke loss programs, I guess, or smoking, not weight loss, quitting smoking?
I don't know the exact statistics for stopping smoking.
What's happening compared to what happened before it wasn't popular to not smoke, I guess.
Yeah,
popular.
I don't know that. I don't have those separate statistics for you. Do you?
No, I was just thinking of a word that had come to mind when these change back things come up. It was sabotage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a sabotage sort of has a negative flair to it, and I want you to anticipate people's change back requests as a part of their healthy response. I say it's very simply their job to ask you to change back, because when their anxiety hits them, their response to their anxiety is going to be to make an action to put you back where in a place that makes them feel comfortable. Now, that doesn't mean we give in to it, but it means we anticipate it. Do you like going to the video store and checking out the Arnold Palmer golf video and then trying to golf that way on Saturday? See, this is what point D is about. We often, you know, where did Arnold Palmer learn to play golf? On the golf course. He lived there. See? If you want to be a New Testament scholar, you don't go and get the quick study manual out of your church. You live in the New Testament. If you want to make any changes, rather than using the quick self-help aids, we need to take the illustrations of St. Paul and Arnold Palmer and all the other people who have, you know, did you like the play the other night? Boy, it was just delightful to watch Ruth act. Could we act? She could give us lessons all week. It takes living in the theater. It takes living in your discipline. It takes living in your area to do that. But what we try to do is we use techniques that set us up to fail. And any technique such as a video that says these are the five steps and then you go do it is a setup. It should say, come live with me on the golf course. But we aren't going to do that, and then we're going to be more clear. I'm not a golfer, I'm a hacker. Now, I can be real comfortable when I go out because I know my role, see? And then I don't get uptight. Well, and then finally, point E, and this is one that I don't want to minimize, although we don't have a lot of time. Professionals, whether in medicine, psychology, healthcare, and religion, have often sold us techniques that sabotage us just because they're bad science. And that's where science is important. Don't want to minimize science today. The easiest illustration I can give you is weight loss. We know that the surest way to make you gain weight is to put you on a low-calorie crash diet. I would love to make that bet with any group in the world, because the best scientific evidence, and one of my good friends is chairman of the National Obesity Foundation, Dr. Herman Frankel, pediatrician from Cornell, absolutely has shown that low-calorie diets cause weight gain. Well, anytime somebody gave you a low-calorie diet, that was a bad technique. No matter how much you tried it, you're going to be in this 98% failure rate. So look at technique carefully. Look at science. Don't disregard the good science on your account. We have some physicians with us, and we could go back in medicine and look at the days where we bled people. That maybe wasn't as good a science as we have now. What I'm saying is use your own mind, use your own diligence to seek out good techniques. We're out of time, but we'll sure stay and take questions or comments for anybody who wants to talk.